Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. It's easy to treat the ongoing and ever-worsening threat of climate change as just another issue. It's not. The consequences of climate change are consequential right now. The consequences are increasing ever faster. And if we fail in addressing climate change, we will be failing everywhere and with everything else. At the same time, we're all human beings with human limitations, and we tend to hang on to perspectives that might have been okay in the past, but are no longer okay. For me, one of those issues is that of nuclear energy. Because of our fossil fuel-driven climate changing, we must transition to a carbon-free source of energy, and because of the limits of solar and wind, I've changed my mind over time to believe that nuclear must be a part of the solution. Today we're going to be talking about the role of nuclear energy and its place in getting to a sustainable world. We're joined by Dr. Jessica Lovering, co-founder of the Good Energy Collective, an organization devoted to the intersection of nuclear energy and climate justice. Her activism stems in part from her studies and research at Carnegie Mellon University in engineering and public policy with a focus on nuclear energy. She is also a fellow with the Energy for Growth Hub, looking at how advanced nuclear can be deployed in emerging economies. She is a nationally recognized spokesperson in these areas. This is part one of my conversation with Dr. Lovering. Dr. Jessica Lovering, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So you're a co-founder of an organization called Good Energy Collective. So let's start off by you describing Good Energy Collective and then follow that up with how come you're there?
Yeah, so Good Energy Collective is a research organization, or sometimes we call it a think tank, but we are looking into policies around nuclear energy. And what motivated to get us started, so I co-founded it with two other women that I'd worked with in the past, is in sort of 2019, 2020, we were seeing a lot of really exciting energy and momentum around aggressive action on climate. And it tended to be coming from younger members in Congress, from new climate organizations that had a focus on not just climate, but environmental justice and really a progressive bent. And we were really excited about that. But we were also all in nuclear energy, and we weren't seeing sort of a similar momentum and excitement working in nuclear. And so we wanted to sort of build a bridge there. There had been, over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, a lot of stuff happening with nuclear energy that we thought was really cool and exciting. A lot of new technologies coming out, and also a lot of bipartisan legislation getting passed to support new nuclear. So we're seeing all this action, and then we're seeing all this energy and momentum around big climate action. But the folks that were working on climate just weren't really talking about nuclear. And the folks that were working on nuclear weren't really engaged on environmental justice and equity issues. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to start an org that could really grapple with the challenges of nuclear, which, you know, we are very clear-eyed about the challenges of nuclear, and really look for solutions and kind of try and build bridges to progressive groups and work on solutions together, rather than say you can't have nuclear because it has problems. Because we really see that, you know, all clean energy technologies have their own problems, and we can't really afford to discount any of them. We need more of everything that's low carbon. So that's how we got started. And so you'll see sort of in our website and in our communications that we're focused on making the progressive case for nuclear, or working at the intersection of environmental justice and advanced nuclear. So that's what we do.
Okay, well,
it's been a good. We just came into our third year, so we've been going for 2 years now.
So just a quick aside question. You mentioned that you had two partners, let's call them, that were instrumental in founding the organization, both women. So are we in a post-gender environment, or have there been some issues for you as a group of women?
So, you know, we knew each other working in the nuclear space. I think there are a lot of women coming up in nuclear right now, especially coming out of graduate programs, going into government, going into research. So there is a bit of a shift. I would say that's one of our diagnoses of challenges that nuclear has had in the past is that it's been very male dominated and also very hierarchical. A lot of connections to the military and sort of that top down structure. And that's led to a lot of problems in how nuclear is viewed and how it's communicated and how it's engaged with the public. And so that was part of it. Not that, us being women would solve that, but that we might have some different perspectives, and that we just wanted to make the space much more open and diverse in general across a lot of different metrics. So bringing in, more social science experts rather than just technology, engineers. So we're looking at all kinds of diversity, and trying to open up the space.
Yeah, I think the days are long gone when we could just say, well, the solutions to our problems are technological. They're so
Absolutely.
multifaceted, and so more diversity amongst folks that are working towards those things is called for. And I just got to toss in as a side. Okay, I'm 78 years old, and when I went to high school, it was just more or less assumed that the boys were going to take math and chemistry and physics, and that the girls were going to do typing and art and home ec and things like that. And so sometimes it's hard to see things changing over a course of a couple, 3 years, but things have changed a lot. Some of them for the better, and some of them not so much. So I think in talking about founding the Good Energy Collective, you kind of filled in a bit about your interest in it. Anything that you want to add that you didn't talk about there in terms of your personal role, your personal interest?
Yeah, so I'll just give a really quick introduction into how I got into nuclear because it is a bit of a weird story. But so I actually come from a physics background. That was my undergraduate degree. And then I started a PhD in astrophysics, actually. But I had always been, really concerned about environmental issues. I was a member of the Green Party. And I had been living in Alaska for a bit and just seeing the impacts of climate change firsthand, receding glaciers, permafrost melting, wildfires. I just started to feel like working on astrophysics was a little too abstract, a little too, not of this earth, and that we had more immediate problems. And so I ended up making a shift into environmental policy and ended up more on the sort of energy policy side. So I felt like that was where a lot of the work needed to be done to fight climate change was on clean energy. And originally I was just focused on renewables because I was living in Colorado and that there's a big renewables industry there. And I just kind of got into nuclear because it was our, the US, the largest source of low carbon electricity, and no one was talking about it. And I just started doing, I do term papers on nuclear issues or group projects on nuclear issues and just kind of kept looking into it. And when I finished my master's degree in environmental policy, I got hired at a think tank in California to sort of stand up their nuclear research and start looking into it. And so I didn't come into nuclear as a, super pro advocate, like this is the silver bullet that solves everything. But I was really brought in because of its challenges and because of its unique, baggage and legacy and wanting to work on those challenges. So I've worked in nuclear policy now, particularly on the innovation side and new technologies for the last 10 years. But I think a lot of the work that needs to be done now is really more on the social sciences side. A lot of the questions and problems that nuclear has are not technological. So that's kind of what got me here today.
Okay, so you've made reference to social sciences a couple times. So talk more about the intersection between the technological or the kind of measurable aspects of our climate challenges and how the social sciences play into that.
Yeah, so there's so many different aspects. I think one of the big ones that's unique to nuclear is risk perception. So when most people, especially environmentalists and people that care about climate change, think about nuclear, their first question is about safety, and they're worried about the risk, they're worried about radiation. And I think, for a long time, nuclear has been the epitome of academic studies on risk perception because it is so different. Nuclear, if you look at just, the raw numbers, nuclear is extremely safe compared to fossil fuels. it's about as has similar mortality as renewable energy. But just telling people that doesn't do anything. And that's not actually how you engage with people's fears and concerns. And so just as an example of something where social sciences really comes in, we do see a really big gap in risk perception around nuclear between genders, but also between white and non-white populations. So people of color in the US rate the risks of nuclear as being much higher than white males. This is often referred to as the white male effect. And it's not just nuclear, a lot of environmental and public health risks see this. And one of the big drivers of that is power structures and power dynamics. So women and people of color tend to have less power in society, especially historically and still today. And so they're more vulnerable to risk. So if there's an accident, whether it's a nuclear accident or a natural disaster, they're going to bear more of the impacts, economic impacts, public health impacts. And so they have a right to be more concerned about potential acts. And so I think coming to terms with that and grappling with it, you need to really understand the problem, and it's a lot different. So I see a lot of, I interact with a lot of these more hard sciences, pro-nuclear advocates that kind of just want to keep hammering home the stats about how safe nuclear is and call people irrational. And, they just need to know more. They just need to get educated and then they'll support nuclear. And that's just not true. It's not science. It's not supported by the science, the social science. And it's just not an effective strategy. And so something that, if you're informed by the social sciences around risk perception, the work looks much more like engaging with people, meeting them where they are, trying to understand their concerns and see if you can work together to find solutions to those problems. And the solutions look very different. I think just sort of ramming through more nuclear projects is not going to make anyone feel good. And so for new nuclear, we're trying to find communities that want to host these facilities and then make sure there's good community engagement in place so that they can help sort of co-design or co-develop the project in a way that meets their needs, not just economic, but, their concerns around safety, their concerns around, environmental risks. And so if the community is more in control, has more power, they'll be much more supportive of the project. And so a lot of that thinking comes from what we've learned from social sciences, but there's also just a lot of unresolved questions that need more social science in terms of how you do this community engagement, how you cite projects that are sort of contentious. And this isn't just unique to nuclear. So renewables, specifically wind and solar, have been seeing a lot more community opposition all across the US and also in Europe, because they do take up a lot more land than nuclear. And so you're seeing communities starting to not just fight renewables projects, but also pass legislation to block renewables projects. And so I think there's a lot that renewables can learn from nuclear, because nuclear has a longer history of community opposition, but there's ways that renewables and nuclear project developers should be working together to sort of share lessons learned, figure out how to do better community engagement, get communities to support their projects, because we just need a lot more of all clean energy technologies.
Yeah, so let's revisit or continue with the conversation a little bit about risk. So it's real clear, as you point out, if you look at the numbers, nuclear historically, by that I mean from the beginning of it up until now, has been exceedingly safe, and especially when you start comparing it against deaths from fossil fuel burning and so on. So I think that there are intelligent people that can look at that and they can say, yeah, but, and the but is the possible catastrophic safety risks of nuclear power. And so, I mean, it's easy, I think, to kind of visualize a kind of a, horrible fires, explosions, people with radiation sickness and so on. And so the question I think people that look at that ask themselves is, although that seems to be unpredictable, it's like something that could happen. So yeah. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. So a good analogy is airplane crashes. So airplanes and traveling in airplanes, especially now, is so much safer than driving in a car. But most people, drive in a car every day, don't really think about it. But a lot of people are very concerned or have fears around flying and airplane crashes. And it's very similar in that you see an airplane crash on the news and it's this big, scary thing. These people had no control over it. It It's very terrifying. And so it's understandable, how people see those types of accidents, and they're not good at sort of comparing, apples to apples risks, and their own risks. But I think what's needed for new nuclear projects is, new nuclear technologies are much safer, even safer than these ridiculously safe plants we already have. But people need to trust that. And so a lot of it comes down to engaging the communities with the safety oversight and making sure the process is really open and transparent. So the regulator in the US, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, does a great job of overseeing safety. It's the gold standard around the world. But they could probably do a lot better job of making sure the public understands that process, understands what's going on, is able to sort of, kick the tires and make sure that this agency is really independent, because that's the concern, is that they're, just doing what the industry wants, which they're not, to be clear. But you can't just tell a community that, like, oh, trust these experts, because that's not done well in the past. And there's lots of reasons not to trust experts, especially with nuclear, coming out of the military and atomic weapons testing. There was a lot that was done without public consent. So trying to make processes that are open and transparent, and that have good community involvement, community engagement. So if the community has a concern, it's really taken seriously, and that they feel that any issue has been addressed. So it's a lot about the process. And when we talk about environmental justice, I think a lot of people think about distribution of impacts. So maybe certain communities are getting a lot of the impacts of air pollution or water pollution. But it's also, environmental justice is also about procedural justice. So you want impacted communities and all the stakeholders to be genuinely involved and have authority over the process. And so that's something where I think, particularly for nuclear, that could be done a lot better, and especially than how nuclear plants were sited in the 60s and 70s, which was much more of this top-down, the utility saying, we want to build a plant here, we're going to build a plant here, and we're just gonna, fight the community with lawsuits and, state decisions and that sort of thing. So that's, I think, where a lot more work needs to be done, but hopefully with genuine community engagement around safety, can help build that trust and that social license, which is a term we like to use. So the community really needs to feel confident in a project.
So community engagement. So my take right now at this point in our social history is that there is a widespread belief that you can be an engaged citizen and the folks with the bucks are going to win every time. You go to the councils, you go to the legislative hearings, you voice your opinion, so on and so forth. The guys with the three-piece suits and the briefcases and the floor shimes show up and it seems like they tend to win. So how would you first of all, I guess I'll just ask you, do you think that that's a fair description of a common perception? And if it is, how do we address that?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a common perception, and that comes to that power dynamic. And that's definitely how nuclear has operated in the past. I think what's changing, and again, this is for renewables and nuclear, but the companies, the developers, the people building these projects are starting to see community opposition as a risk to their business. So if you're trying to develop a wind farm and you're fighting this community the whole time, there's a good chance your project's going to be canceled. Maybe you can't get investors, if there's community opposition. So they're starting to look at this as a business risk and see that if they don't have good community support, there's a risk that the project will get canceled or will get mothballed. And you've seen this happen with nuclear. There's Rancho Seco in California, Shoreham in nuclear in, sorry, New York. And so I think it's happening naturally. And this, comes from a lot of this push around environmental justice, in sort of the last decade, with you really need to have community support for your project successful. And this is something that a case we've been trying to make. There's two sort of big nuclear demonstration projects that are moving forward now, one with TerraPower in Wyoming and one with X Energy in Washington State. And there's a sense that these really need to be successful if there's any future for nuclear in the US as a tool to fight climate change and reduce carbon emissions. And part of that success is having really good community support. So following sort of what these companies are doing to get community support is something a lot of people are watching right now.
So you mentioned X Energy. Of course, I'm talking to you from Tacoma, Washington. So I'm surprised at myself. I'm not familiar with that project. So could you sketch that out briefly for us?
Yeah. So they are, I don't know much. I don't know a ton because they've just, they've announced their site, but they won this big chunk of money from the US government through the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program, which is looking to build, get two advanced nuclear projects online generating electricity by 2027. And they were one of the projects chosen. They're a much smaller design. I'm trying to remember, but it's under a few hundred megawatts. So a typical nuclear plant is, you know, 1,000 megawatts or more. So much smaller. They're building near the site of the Columbia Generating Station, which is the only nuclear power plant in Washington state, near Hanford, Washington. So that's all I know.
Okay.
They're moving forward. Yeah, I know a lot more about the TerraPower project in Wyoming, but there is a lot. You know, TerraPower is actually based out of Washington state. It's got a lot of investment early on from Bill Gates. So there's a surprising amount happening in coming out of Washington state.
Yep. Well, it's a pretty cool state to live in. I'm really happy to live here. And it's nice to love where you live. So let's change gears just a little bit. There are, let's call them greenies, for lack of a better term, green progressives. A lot of them believe that we can power the earth with wind, water, and solar. Dr. Mark Jacobson down at Stanford is one of the most outspoken of advocates of that point of view. In fact, I've taken a course from Dr. Jacobson, and that was part of his pitch. So make the case that we need to have nuclear power in our power pocketbook.
Yeah, so there's a couple different ones, and I will caveat by start by saying that I do believe that we need renewable energy and we need a lot more renewable. And so I want to see it's kind of renewables, but as a scientist, as someone who studied this, I don't think renewables can do it all on their own. So let me explain why that is. It can get technical pretty fast, but it really comes down to how do you power the electric grid. In particular, how do you keep the power running 24/7 all year over many years? And the challenge with wind and solar, and this is not, it's kind of a cliche now, but the sun is not always shining, the wind is not always blowing. And so right now, with the amount of wind and solar that we have on the grid, it's not an issue because we have all of this natural gas that serves as backup. So if it's the nighttime and it's not that windy, you just run your natural gas plants and they're providing the power. Now, as you start to get more and more renewables, this becomes more and more of an issue because you're going to have times where the wind plants are generating five times as much electricity as you actually need. So they have to be curtailed. And there's going to be times where you have zero wind and you're going to need to run a ton of natural gas. But if those natural gas plants are only running a few hours a year, they don't want to stay running. They're losing money. So how do you sort of balance this portfolio of power plants? And this is something utilities are grappling with, and also state public utility commission, California, the California Energy Commission, which is looking at this. And so this sort of deeper penetration of renewables is where this starts to become a problem. And of course, you know, grid scale storage like batteries can help. But it's extremely expensive. Even with batteries coming down in cost, just the amount of cycling you need and sort of the scale of batteries that you need, it's a really challenging problem. We can have a lot more renewables before this becomes an issue. But you do already see this in some places, you know, like in California, just yesterday, we had the highest demand in electricity ever in the state's history. And they were worried about power shortfalls and they were going to have rolling blackouts. And California still has a ton of natural gas. So not having that capacity, even when you know, you have all these power plants that burn natural gas and you know they're there. So in the future, if we don't have as much of that natural gas and we have a lot more wind, it's not as easy to say, okay, turn all the wind plants on because we need it. So balancing the grid is the main issue. And I think The challenge with the work of Mark Jacobson is that he is not doing sort of rigorous grid scale modeling. He's doing what are more like roadmaps or scenarios where he's saying, this is how many megawatt hours of power a wind plant produces on average, and it kind of works out over the year. But if you look at groups doing sort of large scale modeling realities of, when the wind blows and what the grid looks like and what transmission looks like, which is really key, becomes really challenging. And so there's a lot of different studies, and I can share some of them in the program notes with you. There's been a good study that looked at California and found that you can do a lot with 100% renewables. Well, you can get 60% renewables, but you actually save money and decarbonize faster if you include some nuclear in that mix. And so that's something that I think a lot of people are surprised by, because renewables just on a kilowatt hour level look cheaper than nuclear. They look cheaper than natural gas sometimes. But when you're talking about reliable electricity 24/7, including that backup, that's when things start to get expensive at the system level. So if you want to go into the details, there's plenty of studies that do that. But I will say there are a lot of people working on this issue, and it's something that is concerning to utilities. Even utilities like in California, we have this legislation to reach 100% zero carbon electricity by 2045. It's so hard. I've made calls, estate policymakers just trying to figure out how they're going to do it, and it's really challenging. And it's especially challenging if our last nuclear power plant, Diablo Canyon, was to shut down, which is a big reason why it was just extended for another 5 years, because it's just very hard to keep the lights on without it.
Okay, so as you say, a little on the complex side, but I think as citizens, we at least need to have a layperson understanding of what's going on. I mean, in my own case, it was just a few years ago that I cracked the code that electricity has to be generated based on demand. I just sort of like, yeah, you put something into the plug and it works and big deal. And it's far more complex than that. So let's take a break there. I'll have the second half of this conversation with Dr. Lovering next week. And yes, electricity supply, even from a layperson perspective, is complicated. If we as voters, as leaders, as opinion makers are going to have an effective and helpful voice in addressing climate change, this is a field that we must be conversant with, at least from a layperson perspective. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.